Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in German Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Lerner, from the University of Southern California. Today, it's my pleasure to be speaking with Paul DeBryden, assistant professor in the Department of Germanic Languages and Literatures at the University of Virginia. Professor DeBryden holds a PhD in Germanic Studies from the University of California at Berkeley, and he's written about and teaches on a range of topics in modern German cinema, art, and literature, including the book that we'll be speaking about today, The Hygienic Apparatus, which appeared earlier this year with Northwestern University Press. Paul is speaking to us from Berlin. I'm very pleased to have him here today. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Paul. It's nice to be here.
Great. I thought we could start, as we usually do in these podcasts, by giving you an opportunity to say a little bit about yourself, about your path to the field that you've ended up in, and specifically where this research agenda came from, and you know how you got interested in the things that you're interested in.
Sure. So I'm from Ann Arbor, Michigan. It is a college town, but my parents are not academics. My dad's an auto engineer. That might explain some of the car interests that you see in the book. But I studied German since middle school. You could still do that in Michigan at that time. I don't know if that is still the case. But that's how I got started in the language, and took it through college, where I developed an interest in film kind of generally, but then started developing an interest in German film specifically toward the end. And right after college, graduating at the University of Michigan, I worked as a kind of assistant for my mentor there, who was kind of hosting an event called the German Film Institute, which was a kind of long-running workshop put on by Anton Case and Eric Rentschler of Berkeley and Harvard, respectively, which was a kind of week-long workshop for academics working in German cinema. And as a kind of assistant to my mentor, who was the organizer that year, I first got to see a bunch of things. The topic was Unknown Weimar, and so we ordered a bunch of films, rolls of film from the Kinematheque here, and screened them in Ann Arbor. And so I got to see a lot of very strange and fascinating things. And then second, I got to sit in on the discussions that were happening, the workshop discussions that were happening that week, and got a taste of kind of what it was like to be in a room with people who knew a whole lot about something that I found really interesting. And it was just a really exciting kind of galvanizing event for me. I ended up after a year, a DAD year in Berlin, going to Berkeley to study with Anton Case, and really focused on German film history and Weimar era film in particular. Now, like just generally, like how I kind of got to the topic of the book, I would say my kind of enduring fascination is with cinema as like a perceptual environment, right? As a kind of like space that makes possible certain kinds of aesthetic experiences. And thinking about that in the early 20th century, kind of in relation to other modern, like built or designed spaces whose like sensory characteristics kind of fascinated the critics of that time. So you could think of like Georg Simmel writing about the Gewerbeausstellung, or you know, Benjamin on the arcades or the urban street, Krakauer, who is like a kind of connoisseur of all of these kinds of different spaces of modernity. So like these spaces that who's like designed or organized, you know, built character seem to like unlock something about modernity as such. And so this is kind of how I think of the cinema, like in relation to that, like geography of modern spaces or spaces of modernity. And then I think like what I'm trying to do in the book is kind of link that idea of a cinema to a more kind of environmental thinking. So linking this like idea of a perceptual environment to thinking about like material environments and kind of ecologies of modernity and trying to think those two things together in a certain way.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I found so fascinating about the book was the way it's working on multiple levels. And as you say, you're really investigating the cinema space as a kind of environment or perceptual experience, but then you analyze the content of films as well, but you know, the medium and kind of conditions of their production. And one of the things that I think makes this book so exciting is that it's very tight, but also kind of radiates out in all sorts of directions. So I wondered if you could talk about, especially for people who haven't had a chance to read the book yet, what you mean by hygienic apparatus, and you know how this category works in your analysis.
Sure. So that word apparatus is meant to kind of resonate in two different ways, and I'll try to explain that as I go. But maybe first to give a sense of the idea of hygiene that I'm working with. I think you know it's a very like historically loaded word that has a lot of different resonances for people who might, you know, be familiar with it from different contexts, right? So things like social hygiene or racial hygiene. So what I'm focusing on in the book is what historian Alphonse Labisch calls experimental hygiene, a phrase I like from another historian, Dita Mekici. She says that this form of hygiene was the physiology of the everyday spaces the body occupied. So it was about a kind of hygiene that is thinking about material environments and how they affect the health of the people who live, work, travel within them, right? So it's about kind of quantifying all these environments, the home, the street, the workplace, the school, the city itself, like thinking kind of at different scales. And examining those things or analyzing them in terms of like certain kinds of environmental disorder that can harm health, thinking about pollution, air pollution, water pollution, but also like, you know, the intensity of light or, you know, how well a space is ventilated, all these kinds of things that can affect an environment. And so it's trying to examine and analyze these spaces and then make them healthier, basically. So it has a kind of environmental approach to health. So it's not medicine, right? Medicine is like treating individual patients, you know, after something happens. This is thinking about like the collective environments that we inhabit and how those affect health, kind of the level of the overall population. So what I mean by an apparatus, I think I came to this pretty slowly, but I was looking for a way to evoke the real huge range of things that this could include, right? So there were all sorts of little sub-disciplines of hygiene, like school hygiene, you know, industrial hygiene, hygiene of the home. You know, if you look at the guide to the 1911 hygiene exhibition in Dresden, for instance, like it has a whole huge range of different kinds of spaces that it's that it has exhibits on, right? And so this, I take this Foucauldian definition of apparatus. It's a translation of the French dispositif, which he calls a heterogeneous ensemble consisting of discourses, institutions, architectural forms, regulatory decisions, laws, administrative measures, scientific statements. And it's a kind of system of relations between all of these different elements. And hygiene had all of these things, right? It had different forms of expertise from the sciences, and kind of different kinds of like regulatory bodies. And then it was applying those kinds of expertise to the various spaces that made up modernity. And so it's not, you know, it's not a super coherent sort of like project, but it's a kind of project that has a certain loose coherence, but spread across a very, you know, a variety of different institutions and sciences and endeavors, like a lot, most often like at the municipal level, right? And so these various kinds of hygiene and hygienic practice and hygienic knowledge form a kind of dispositif or apparatus that I think does have some, you know, some coherency that we can call a kind of like modernizing project. And it was a way that kind of modernization was thought about, right? To kind of make the city hygienic was to make it modern, right? To kind of make it civilized in a certain way. So that I think is maybe the best way I could describe this concept of the hygienic apparatus.
Thank you. That's a very clear description. I was going to wait and ask you about this later, but it's hard to listen to this discussion of the operation of hygiene in this period and not think about terms like social hygiene and racial hygiene, which, of course, have gotten so much attention in the historiography of eugenics and so-called race science. And so I wondered if you could think a little bit about, as you do toward the end of the book, about how those regimes fit into this kind of larger dispositif or hygienic apparatus that you've discussed here.
Sure. I mean, so like, as you say, those have gotten, I would say, more scholarly attention, at least in the kinds of like scholarship that I'm in dialogue with. And so there are these different varieties of hygiene, and we tend to think of it now more as like a body-focused sort of discipline. And so I wanted to emphasize this environmental aspect, which was really important starting kind of in the late 19th century, and really I think was kind of the dominant meaning of the term at that point. But of course, you have these other versions of hygienic practice, and I think they have sometimes like synergistic relationships to this form of environmental hygiene. So you could say you have a racial hygienist who argues, well, it's good to have healthy environments because that will, like, you know, improve the fitness of the race or something like this. But then there's ways in which they're less compatible. So you had, you know, very strong disagreements between experimental and racial hygienists about like who constitutes the population, what it is, you know, what is hygiene for? Is it meant to kind of foster the health of everyone, or kind of like focus on those who are most productive, and that those sorts of like distinctions among deserving and undeserving peoples and that sort of thing. Experimental hygiene had a lot of collaboration, I would say, with social hygiene. So thinking about, for instance, working class housing as a major site of intervention for these kinds of hygienic projects, the goal of kind of making the living spaces of working class people hygienic involved thinking about not just the environments, the kind of like the Mietshäuser or rental barracks as the kind of like classic topos of that, but also, of course, experts like examining the sociology of the home spaces and like monitoring them for who is, you know, sleeping next to whom and who is drinking and who is, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So they work together, I would say, in a lot of ways. But I think it is important to like bring out this environmental dimension, at least from my perspective, to kind of place it within, I would say, like a history of modern ways of thinking about environments. We tend to think of like environmentalism often in terms of like conservation movements and that sort of thing. But I think this is a really important way that that people thought about environments, and I think continues to operate in a certain way to this, you know, to this day, and is worth bringing it out and seeing how it interacted with other kind of modern phenomena.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's, you know, because you use the word environment so frequently in the book, in different ways at times. I think it's, and given our current moment now, it's kind of hard to read the book without thinking about the environment in this kind of more ecological sense that we think about it now, and thinking about Umgebung, or the, you know, the different terms you can use in German to express that. And I am kind of wondering where the, what, for lack of a better word, we might call it the ecological movement or the conservation movement. I mean, is that a complete, on a completely different trajectory? And kind of here you're much more concerned with regulation of the urban topography, the household, the street, the cinema, those kinds of spaces. And or are there places where these different discourses kind of intersect and work together?
I don't think they're really separate. The historian, the environmental historian Joachim Rodkau, kind of situates the beginnings of environmentalism also in this period of kind of like the sanitation movement, specifically in the UK, for instance. And I think what the thing it shares with what we think of as a more kind of modern environmentalist movement is this concern with the effects of industrialization on the environment and on health, right? So think of something like Silent Spring, which is like thinking about the effects of modern agricultural practice on, you know, on the health of both like people and animals. You know, it's a not too far afield to think about environmental or kind of environmentally oriented hygiene from the early 20th century in this way. But they're thinking about it mostly in urban context. So there are these kind of like environmental, these bad environmental effects that come out of industrialization and urbanization, and they're trying to manage them and control them. There's a sense that the environment is being degraded, and that is affecting social reproduction in some way, right? Like it's affecting the health of our population and our, you know, specifically our laboring population, and how can we kind of manage those effects or mitigate them so that society and modernization kind of modern capitalism can continue apace. So there is maybe a different emphasis than kind of environmentalism, although there are different strains of modern environmentalism, some more accommodating of capitalism and some less so, I would say. But this hygiene was definitely kind of in service of this like kind of project of capitalist modernity, but trying to mitigate its impacts on the health of populations.
That's really interesting, really suggestive answer. I wonder if we can see how kind of come down from the clouds a little bit and get into some specific examples and see how some of this is actually functioning right within films themselves or the experience of seeing films. And one thing that's interesting about the book, I think, is that you deal with films that are familiar to people who have a German studies background, like Kulawampa, for example, but also many films that one, unless one were a specialist in that particular area, they would have no reason to know existed, right? Like these traffic films and safety films and Strudel des Verkehrs in the thick of the traffic, for example. So I just wondered if we could talk about any of these particular films or film-going experiences and kind of see how some of this functions in a particular context. And I'll give you, anywhere you want to go is fine with me. I'm personally struck by the traffic films, as you can tell, but I'm happy to go any direction.
Sure, yeah. I would say we can maybe get there by way of the space of the cinema itself, which was also a kind of space of various kinds of traffic that were in need of in need of regulation, right? So in the book overall, like I'm trying to think about the different ways in which this kind of encounter between, hygiene from the late 19th century encounters cinema and vice versa as cinema develops in the early 20th century. And the kind of first encounter between the two is around this space of the movie theater, where there's a lot of kind of anxiety among bourgeois and middle-class critics about the space of the movie theater, right? It's associated with working-class audiences, female audiences. And it's often described as a kind of space of contagion and kind of a space of dangerous kinds of material traffic. And so there's a desire to kind of regulate it in a certain way. And so this, you know, on the one hand, this kind of anxiety about the movie theater as a space of contagion, which influences later thinking about how to make a healthy cinema space. But I think another way we can think about this hygienic regulation of the theater is this concern about fires and concern about, you know, the theater as a space of like fire danger. And you can sort of chart gradually how the various, you know, kinds of regulations grow up around the theater treating it as a space of a kind of specific kind of danger, specifically like the projector fire, the projection room as like a particularly kind of dangerous space. And it's sort of interesting to see how those regulations develop, right? On the one hand, they deal with the auditorium. So thinking about like how people are moving through the theater, how the seats are situated, how the exits are situated, how to kind of, you know, illuminate the exit signs, those sorts of things to make sure there's a kind of like safe and orderly environment or traffic through the theater. And, you know, those develop out of like older regulations around like theaters, like traditional sorts of theaters. But then, you know, the cinema has this specific technology of the projector and the screen. And so there needs to, the cinema becomes like its kind of own architectural genre in a regulatory sense, as the fire regulators like start to realize, okay, here's this space that needs controlling. So there's all sorts of regulations about what kinds of materials it can be built out of, you know, how the projector can be situated and built and so on and so forth. And so that's a very like material way in which these kinds of like hygienic approaches to the environment are like, you know, influencing the ways that movie going happens. You know, as I said, there's a lot of concern about traffic specifically. This word verkehr comes up a lot in various ways. We can think of that as circulation of various forms of bodies and materials, later, you know, as film becomes more of an educational medium, we can see like films concerned with other kinds of traffic as they occur, like in the kitchen or in the home or in the street, right? So I do look at this traffic safety film called Im Strudel des Verkehrs. You know, we might not think of like traffic safety as a hygienic concern necessarily. You know, if we're thinking about what affects, you know, health and life or death in the modern city, like automobiles and modern forms of transportation are a big factor. So the same sorts of folks who were producing films about like domestic hygiene, about how to keep your home hygienic, we're producing films about traffic safety. This producer at the Medical Film Archive of the UFA, kind of Kulturfilm division, Tomala He was writing about how, like, we need to be thinking of accidents and, like, work accidents and traffic accidents as part of this hygienic project. And so we can read this, like, traffic safety film that's, like, telling people how to, you know, how to behave properly in the urban street. I think as part of this, like, project of environmentally oriented hygiene that is trying to keep people safe.
It's really fascinating that I want to get back to traffic safety in a moment, but you know, having written about department stores in this period, I see so many fascinating parallels between the cinema as space and the department store as space, and the concern with fires, this kind of regulatory project of what I saw in my sources, often this kind of notion of the human stream of, you know, channeling it from the street into the store through the different displays, and both as a kind of spur to more, you know, selling more stuff and more retail turnover, but also as a danger. And, you know, this human stream of, you know, even going back to 19th century novels like Zola, when there's a sale in the department store and the women can't contain themselves, right? There's this kind of hysterical mob that then drowns, you know, some of the people who are less able to protect themselves. So I just wanted to kind of flag that, because I found those parallels between cinema as space and department store as space, sites of spectacle, of a very gendered, right? I mean, mostly women, at least in some cinema situations, kind of a customer basis, connected to the growth of this consumer culture, this kind of Weimar consumer culture phenomenon. I'm struck also by the transformation of the cinema from a site of danger into a site of sort of Aufklärung, enlightenment, education. And is there, because earlier in the book you talk about this kind of miasma, you know, the environment of site of contagion, and you use the Faust film, I thought, very effectively to talk about some of the kind of this capturing these, you know, these contaminants and so forth in the film itself. But I wondered if you could sort of talk about that shift or that transition of the cinema as a site of danger to a site of education and enlightenment.
Right. So, you know, before World War One, you know, it's not really taken seriously as an educational medium. Although there are some people in this kind of cinema reform movement that are thinking about that. What really spurs that is this sense during the war, or this realization during the war that our sort of enemy countries are way ahead and using film for propaganda purposes in ways that Germany was very slow to do, but by the end of the war kind of realized the value of film as a medium of propaganda and kind of mass communication. And then that continues after the war, but is kind of channeled toward this purpose of national reconstruction and kind of reconstructing the body of the German people, right? So there's this sense that, I mean, they're not just a sense, but there's like malnutrition, there's disease, you know, there's people coming back wounded. That the body, the kind of Volkskörper, is in dire straits, and we need to kind of use all the means possible to kind of reconstruct this national body, and so film becomes part of that endeavor. And so I'm looking at these specific films that deal more with environments or, you know, spaces of the city, but there's of course films about, you know, kind of sexual education. And other kinds of like bodily hygiene and that sort of thing. And so there's, you know, a whole range of films that have been looked at by others, and I'm focusing on these films on kind of various kinds of urban spaces.
It's having grown up in a period where we were shown films about, you know, sex education, about drugs and what they can do to you, about bicycle safety. I mean, it seems to me in some way that whole genre must come out of the moment that you're capturing here.
I believe that's right. I mean, I know the historian Anya Laukutter, who has written about a kind of comparative study of educational films in the early 20th century, and I think there's some kind of also like international connections there. The figure that I talked about wrote for this, contributed to an international kind of educational cinema journal, I think in Britain. And so I think there is thinking across the Atlantic as well, about how to use these films in an educational context. I did want to say that, even though, you know, there is this boom in kind of educational film or what we're called sometimes Kulturfilme, there's, I think, still always a kind of suspicion of the movies as being too powerful or too seductive. And so that affects the form of these films, insofar as they were often shown with lecturers. So someone who could kind of guide the audience's viewing of the film and kind of guide their interpretation of the film, right? You don't want to leave it just up to the viewer to decide what it means for themselves. Or you have in the film a kind of figure that mimics that lecturer function, who's directly addressing the audience. And so making, you know, reminding the audience, like, you're not here alone. We're kind of like monitoring your interpretation, and, you know, remember your duty to society, and so on and so forth. And so there's always this fear that people are going to kind of lose themselves in the movies, and that needs to be counteracted, you know, either by a kind of external instance of a lecturer or an internal figure that serves a similar function.
One of the questions I had as I was reading was about kind of the audience for some of these films, and whether people chose to see these films, or if they were in situations where they're being shown them in schools or at their workplace. And I know that the Dusseldorf police, I think you said they re-edited the Traffic film for their own purposes. But I can certainly understand how some of the more popular Weimar films that we hear about so much today still, how they could have that effect on an audience. But are people sincerely concerned that Traffic films and sexual enlightenment films are going to be too kind of titillating for the audience? And is there are people going to see those films voluntarily, or are they being shown in schools and workplaces?
Yeah, generally it's more of these non-theatrical contexts. Like with the Traffic film, I think the idea was to have it screened in classrooms, or for, you know, for school classes. And I don't think there's a real serious fear that those are, the Traffic film at least is too kind of exciting. But there is a concern that, like, I think at this time, especially, the police were very anxious about their own image, and wanting to maintain their own authority. And so there might be a fear that the kids are going to laugh at the police. And so you want to, like, make sure that they are respecting authority properly. Now, with the sexual education films, that's much more of a, of an issue, that this worry that audiences aren't going for educational purposes, but to because they're kind of sensational, and wanting, and that, yeah, this worry that the audience is using it in a kind of improper way.
So there you need the sober figure, whether within the film or just to make sure nobody's, you know, having too much fun here. So the Foucauldian influence is clear here, and you've mentioned the dispositif kind of as the organizing principle for a lot of the work in this book. And you've also brought up a couple of historians and others as in the discussion as it's developed here. But I wondered if you could tell us more about the kind of theoretical influences that shaped you as a scholar, and in particular the work you did in this book.
Yeah, so certainly I would say there's a lot of Foucault in the background of this, and I think so. Part of the project you could describe is like trying to think about biopolitics from an environmental perspective, and kind of like thinking about approaches, modern approaches to the environment in relation to like a biopolitical project of the population. And like how film like both fit into that project and then resisted it in certain ways or offered kind of space of resistance. More generally, like I think I'm very influenced also by what sometimes is called the modernity thesis. So this like thinking about modernity specifically, which is was discussed a lot in film studies in the kind of early 2000s. And so, like I emphasize the way that both cinema and hygiene were kind of like modernizing forces or ways in which modernity was experienced, and the ways that those two things kind of play out or interact together, and then finally, like being at Berkeley, we talked a lot about the kind of like interaction between aesthetics and historical context. So kind of from a new historicist perspective. And so I don't want to call this book like a kind of exhaustive historical account necessarily. Like I think it could go in various directions. But what I'm concerned with, I think in the chapter specifically where I'm dealing with films and kind of thinking about how spaces are represented, I'm very concerned with the different ways in which or kind of identifying specifically what kind of work a film is doing on what different levels within a very kind of concrete historical situation. So how can we think about a film in relation to a particular historical context and historical discourses to identify the different kinds of work it's doing that you wouldn't really see otherwise. I look, I would say, at different kinds of ways films are doing work in different chapters, whether that's kind of pedagogical work or trying to shape vision in certain ways or shape subjectivity in certain ways, or experimenting with different kinds of aesthetic materials like particulates like smoke and fog and that sort of thing. So trying to think about the different levels on which a film is working in relation to a very specific historical context.
That makes a lot of sense, and it really gives another way in which your work on these disparate films and these disparate contexts is all kind of unified, that there's a kind of seeing the film as doing a kind of work really allows you, I think, to range into quite different kinds of contexts and cinematic representations in ways that I don't see a lot in. I mean, maybe that says more about what I read, but I was really struck and struck in a very positive way by, the seeing your analysis of these very different kinds of materials. I thought that was one of the really fascinating ways that this book operates. I can't help but ask you, given the focus on media and on, in particular here, I'm thinking, back to the earlier parts of the book when you're writing about the kind of notions of the cinema as a space of danger and contagion, and you have those choice examples of, for example, shutting down the movie theaters in Berlin during the influenza pandemic. So I know that you did a lot of the writing or finishing of this book during the kind of height of the coronavirus pandemic. And I can't help but think about what it would have been like to be in lockdown writing a book about, managing environments, about the hygienic apparatus. And so could you reflect a little bit about that experience and about, the century between the material you're writing about and the context in which you wrote about it and how things have changed or not changed in terms of media and environment?
Sure. I think, obviously there are some kind of immediate resonances, right? At the very beginning of COVID, movie theaters were one place where, they started either shutting them down or instituting kind of distancing, requiring masks. There was like a a whole project of like how to kind of make a safe movie theater amidst a pandemic, right? And so this echoes these earlier discourses about pandemic sort of cinemas as spaces of contagion. And I think what the pandemic on one hand made us all very aware of was the spaces that we occupy, and who is in them, how many people are in them, like who is masked or not masked, and so on and so forth. So we like are suddenly very intensely aware of our material environments, and maybe in ways that we would not have been before. But on the other hand, I would say after a couple of years now, what strikes me is the very just complete absence of a collective modernizing project, right? There's no sense that we are going to like try to, at least in the United States, improve our ventilation or just kind of like modernize the spaces in which we exist in order to make this thing less dangerous. And we're just left with these sort of like individual hygienic stop gaps, like you can wear a mask or you're for yourself or not, and we're not going to require anyone else to. And so I would say we have a very very weak hygienic apparatus that is not really it's just not part of our horizon. We're I think all beaten down by kind of neoliberal disinvestment. The state seems not very invested in the health of its population, and so there's not a sense that we need to kind of modernize everything. And so I think in terms of media, what occurs to me is thinking about if the movie theaters were dangerous, like it was because they brought people together. They're like a space of a collective space, right, where everyone is kind of coming together for a single purpose. But now that's not really the dominant form in which we consume moving images. They're much more consumed at home, more individually in more domestic spaces. And the way that then work and schooling also moved into those domestic spaces, I think really makes us aware of the kind of like hygienic function of media in our particular moment. So media being used as a kind of dispersive technology that can separate people and separate bodies while still enabling certain kinds of reproductive work, schooling and certain kinds of jobs that can happen in a dispersed way rather than in a kind of collective space. Now, at the same time, these kinds of media are also bringing people together in different ways, whether it's like ordering food on apps and that sort of thing, or whatever it is. But I would say that we can start to think about how media are structuring our environments and our interaction with kind of space and other people. At least in this particular moment, we become aware of how that's happening and the different kind of hygienic uses of media. I think that's they're so important to us because they're kind of easy to use, right? It's much cheaper to like use Zoom than to rebuild a university building so that it's properly ventilated, right? And so in kind of the absence of a real modernization of our built spaces, we can kind of try to manage it with these more mediated forms of interaction.
I had on a kind of reflexive level, I guess I had kind of thought of the hygienic apparatus as something to be feared, but even though I of course sympathize with many of its goals about safety and order and so forth, but now in the absence of a hygienic apparatus, where as you say, we've kind of given up on controlling COVID and we've left it to individuals, and there's nothing but chaos and randomness and kind of our larger response to it. I've begun to suddenly see, suddenly miss it in the face of this kind of neoliberal tyranny that we're in.
Yeah, I mean, there's been, I think, some people writing more in the public sphere have like drawn attention to kind of 19th century architectural technologies of health, and the way buildings were constructed so as to be extremely well ventilated so that contagion didn't happen as readily. So I think there has been some attention to these kinds of hygienic innovations that were pioneered during this time of public health. Now, right, that's not to say that these weren't very kind of allied to this project of developing capitalist modernity. And so we would want to be careful about how much inspiration we take from them, right? If you look at these, something interesting, I think, about the films that I talk about, at least these more educational films, is they demonstrate what orderliness or kind of environmental orderliness is supposed to look like. And in so doing, they're also forced to kind of show what kind of social order they imagine to be inhabiting that environment, right? So we learn not just like what belongs where, but who belongs where. And, you know, the kitchen is for the housewife, the street is for the kind of able-bodied worker, not the child, not the elderly person, right? These visions of hygienic order are also tied to a kind of vision of a social order that is patriarchal, ableist in a lot of ways. We'd want to be, I think, careful about importing it into our moment.
That's a very useful and sobering corrective to my kind of having let myself get nostalgic for something, which I think is really
dangerous.
I totally
get it, though. We could certainly use some of this, I think, desire to like make our spaces healthier. Totally.
That surely is innocuous enough. Yeah. Maybe as we start to wind down our discussion of the book, I can come back to something I brought up earlier, which is thinking about the offshoot of the hygienic apparatus that kind of folds itself neatly into National Socialism. And here in the book, you discuss it with the film Blut und Boden, Blood and Soil. That's clearly only one, having this regulatory hygienic regime of ordering environments doesn't have to lead to fascism, but it may lead to fascism. Or I wondered if you could kind of talk about what, and here I'm thinking of your use of Detlef Peukert, for example, in his essay on the spirit of science, sort of in what ways this kind of set of practices and discourses is generative of fascist solutions, and in what ways it's kind of part of the larger, part of larger capitalist modernity in the West.
Right. So, yeah. So I kind of use this early Nazi film, Blood and Soil, as a kind of marker to end the book, where this film is about kind of rejecting the urban in favor of the land, right, and envisioning the expansion of the German people like into the land and developing it productively and this sort of thing, and to me that marks a kind of break with this vision of modernity that this earlier hygienic apparatus had envisioned, which was very allied to urbanization, and tried to basically envision the city as the site of modernity, as the site of development, but making it healthy. There's this idea that we can kind of reform the city to be this healthy space of capitalist development. But what happens, right, is an economic crisis that sort of takes the floor out of that, out from underneath it, and constrains that vision. It makes it basically impossible. And so in the absence of that, this is when eugenic ideas start to really gain a lot of steam, because it's much cheaper to kind of like distinguish very strongly between deserving and undeserving, as opposed to like remaking the environment in such a way that it like benefits a kind of mass of people. I'd say like two different kinds of biopolitics operating in those two different models, right? In the kind of pre-fascist and then fascist moments. But they both are concerned with like developing the population, about a concern with fitness in a certain way. It's just that and I don't think that the former necessarily leads to the latter by any means. But you see the way in which such a vision that maybe looks more kind of collective and innocuous, when it encounters the constraints of capitalism, like when there's a crisis, it doesn't really hold up, and it doesn't really keep operating, and it doesn't. It really is only possible under a certain sense of economic well-being, and when that goes away, it easily kind of makes way for much more violent forms of biopolitics.
I think that's a great place to end our discussion of your book, and I'm really grateful that you've given us so much time today. I think what I'd like to give you a chance to talk a little bit about new projects and give us a sense of some of the issues that you're working on right now in your current research.
Sure, thank you. So one chapter in the book actually deals with images of disability and aging in both kind of nonfiction pedagogical films and some fiction films of the Weimar Republic. And this came out of the thinking about the ways in which hygiene imagined environments for certain kinds of bodies, right? Particularly the laboring, productive body, whether that's the kind of home domestic labor or the kind of more male-dominated sphere of like wage labor. And this, so it's not a vision that accommodates disability or other kinds of kind of embodied difference very well. The book kind of takes a more bodily turn, I would say, as it progresses. And my current work is really focused on thinking about disability in film during the Weimar Republic, and thinking about the 20s, especially as a kind of period of particular anxiety around able-bodiedness, right? So if the able body is kind of defined by, you know, what it means to labor under a certain economic, political, technological regime, modernity is always changing that. And so there's like a lot of room for anxiety about what constitutes able-bodiedness or able-mindedness. So I have an essay on the Fritz Lang film M, which reads the film in terms of this anxiety about able-bodiedness and the ability to identify or not identify it in public. I'm currently working on an essay on Bela Balázs's The Visible Man, which is an early book of film theory, which thinks about film from the perspective of the body, but in a lot of its language is kind of constructing this vision of a new kind of visible human being against an image of the disabled body. But there's also a kind of interesting fascination there with the kind of non-normative bodily possibilities of film. And so I think I'm pursuing this kind of hypothesis that the 20s is a period of anxiety around able-bodiedness, and film is playing a role in that because it's redefining what it means to be kind of part of culture. It's redefining how the body is seen in certain ways. I'm trying to think about those two things together.
Well, that's great. I look forward to seeing the results of some of this new work. Sounds like you're picking up on some of the themes here and then pushing them in new directions, which I really look forward to seeing.
Thank you.
So I really want to thank you for your time today. I want to remind everybody that The Hygienic Apparatus, Weimar Cinema and Environmental Disorder was published by Northwestern University Press. You can purchase it through the press or wherever you buy books. And Paul, once again, I want to thank you for spending so much time with me today. And I've really learned so much from your book and have enjoyed so much this opportunity to engage with the ideas in it.
Thank you. It was really nice talking to you.